I'm Tom Hall. Welcome to Maryland Morning. We'll start with the race for mayor in Charm City. SRB is out, Sheila Dixon is in and hoping for a comeback. Catherine Pugh came in second the last time. Nick Mosby and Carl Stokes may not be the only current city council members vying for the top job. And there's no shortage of political newcomers making or expected to make a bid. Then, WANN, a radio station in Annapolis that began in the 1940s, and an exhibition at the Smithsonian about its importance as the source of jazz and dance music to a growing African-American middle class. Plus, Ensemble Galilei. They've toured the world, and they're stopping into Studio A today to introduce their new CD. Gil Sandler has a Baltimore story. Nathan Sterner has the local news. We'll launch this Friday edition of Maryland Morning right after the national headlines.
I'm producer Jonna McCone. To catch the news, you'll need to listen to us live on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday mornings at 9 o'clock on 88.1 FM in Baltimore and Frederick, 106.9 in Ocean City, and streaming online at wypr.org/listen. Now, on with the show.
And good morning, everybody. On 88.1, it's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. The Democratic primary for mayor takes place 6 months from now, on the 26th of April. When Stephanie Rawlings Blake won the last mayoral election in 2011, it was decided to grant her and other Baltimore elected officials an extra year in office so that the mayor's race could be aligned with the presidential primary. The federal and local general election will take place in November of 2016, making the general election season for mayor considerably longer than it was the last time around, when the primary preceded the general election by less than 2 months. So today we'll take stock of the candidates for mayor who have announced so far, as well as a few who are expected to run, but who have not yet announced. I'm joined by two folks who keep a close eye on the local political scene. Fern Shen is the founder and editor of the Baltimore Brew. Taylor Stewart is the regional director of Leadership for Educational Equality. It's nice to see both of you. Good morning. So, Taylor, tell us what Leadership for Educational, is it equity or equality?
Equity.
Equity. Yeah. Sorry about that.
It's all right.
So, the Leadership for Educational Equity, what kind of work do you all do?
Yeah, so we're an organization that works with teachers and former teachers to help them get involved in politics, policy, and advocacy here in Baltimore. So we think about it through community organizing and having our teachers be able to raise a voice from their classrooms about how we should be funding schools for our kids. But then also, we have individual leadership of former teachers being able to bring their experience from the classroom into public office, into helping out in policy positions or in advocacy organizations.
Yeah, so politics is an important dimension of what you all do.
Very important. Yeah.
And we should make clear that you're not here speaking on behalf of your organization. You're just giving us your
exactly. I'm a private citizen this morning.
There you go. You're all out. So Fern Shen, you know, when Stephanie Rawlings Blake decided not to seek re-election, that was something of a shell shock to a lot of folks. With the field as that we currently have, Nick Mosby just announced a few days ago that he's running. Former Mayor Sheila Dixon, Senator Kathy Pugh, Carl Stokes, a council member from the 12th District, and a few others. Is there any punitive front runner at this moment? Is there a person to beat?
I think before the mayor dropped out, you know, you would have said Sheila.
Sheila Dixon, yeah.
But I think a lot of the air was taken out of that whole thing when she, when the mayor dropped out, because, you know, Sheila was the, her whole concept was, you know, anybody but Stephanie beat the incumbent. And so that was kind of, you know, her legs were knocked out from under her with that. And so now I think people are still shell-shocked by the, you know, change in the universe here, and I don't see any of them as a front runner quite yet.
So Taylor Stewart, this really is an open race, and without the current mayor, without the incumbent, you know, to sort of knock around, they really got to start from scratch. Do you have a sense of what the big issues are going to be?
Yeah, so I think that you get the pollsters who will say that crime and grime are going to be what this election's driven on, but I actually think that there are people in Baltimore talking about issues around education and are talking about issues around youth opportunities and development throughout the city and jobs. I think after April, we've seen a lot of folks being able to get far more involved in a lot of these deeper issues that have been driving our city. So I think that the candidates are going to have to be able to talk a little bit more about some really complicated issues for our city.
I went last night to a meeting of BUILD, Baltimoreans United in Leadership Development, and a big focus of their efforts over the next several months is going to be voter registration. Reverend Glenna Huber, who was one of the BUILD co-chairs, said last night that, for example, in Sandtown, Winchester, in 2011, there were 1,012 registered voters, and only 137 people from that neighborhood voted. So she's leading the charge, she and others, to say, come on, we've got to get involved. We've got to get people out. They're not endorsing anybody. They're not saying who to vote for, but they're saying to vote. Fernshen, do you think that there's a candidate, what do candidates need to do to get the electorate fired up, to get them interested, to get them out to the polls?
Well, I think they need to show that they are not going to be about business as usual and not going to be sort of status quo candidates who represent kind of how things have always been done around here. I mean, you look at the array of people who are, declared or interested, and it's, these are people who are veterans of the city council, city hall process. The race right now to a lot of people is very sort of disappointing in that, you don't have a lot of hope for fresh thinking. It's sort of like the hot air balloon that we just is drifting off. It's, this race is it is a lot of sloganeering and, people who are, mm-hmm. insiders. So, there's the topics that you're talking about that, I think would excite people, the everyday topics of, our city services really being provided that help people in their day-to-day life. Is the money being accounted for properly in the city that, if we don't have audits as we haven't for decades, people really don't like paying these high taxes and not knowing where, what it's really being spent on. And then finally, the other issue that, your group BUILD, and many everyday people just wonder about is downtown development, harbor development. Has that really sucked all the resources and attention away from government at the expense of the east and west sides?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Carl Stokes, who's one of the candidates for mayor, has sort of made that a big calling card of his over the years, sort of being opposed to the concentration on development of places like the Inner Harbor and Harbor East in mm-hmm. favor of other neighborhoods. Taylor Stewart, what about the so-called character issues? We've got, Nick Mosby having questions about whether the fact that he's married to the state's attorney is going to influence his performance were he to be elected. We've got former Mayor Sheila Dixon, who is, obviously tainted with the fact that she was kicked out of office, because of legal transgressions. In the case of Sheila Dixon, do you think people are ready to sort of forgive and forget and give her another shot?
I don't think that there's a consensus answer in Baltimore on that question. I've talked to some folks who have mentioned, are we really one of those cities that is going to end up electing a mayor who has, while in office, was convicted of a crime? And so then we have some folks who, and I can talk from my former students, who were like, I actually knew what was going on in the city and I can respect what she did as mayor. And so I think it depends in Baltimore, but I do think that with those character issues, it's really important for the candidates to address them. With Nick Mosby, I think he's taking a tack right now that it's not something that people care about. But it would become something that people care about if there's a case that is coming before one of his departments and his wife is the one who's supposed to prosecute it. So I think these are things that we should hear about now, of what are their plans and how are they thinking about those character issues.
Yeah,
I think that's been brought up pretty well, and a good example that people can grasp on this conflict of interest issue is the housing department investigation right now. Paul Graziano and the,
allegations
about the
requesting
sexual
favors.
Yeah,
for,
yeah.
Repairs,
so
yeah.
So what if Nick Mosby were mayor at the time of this happening? So essentially, it would be his wife, the state's attorney, investigating an official who was under his authority. you know, the conflict is pretty clear.
Yeah, and something that I think he will continue to respond to through the campaign. How about State Senator Catherine Pugh? She had a very high profile during the unrest in April, which took place in the district she represents. Fern Shen, what do you think? I mean, she came in second the last time to Mrs. Rawlings Blake. She lost by, you know, quite a few votes, 20,000 votes in the primary in 2011. But her profile did increase last spring. Do you think that'll help her in this election?
I didn't see a ton of it. She was visible. I don't know, but I didn't hear a lot of insight. I sort of saw her visibility, but I don't know if voters saw enough, you know, real action or input from her. So I sort of feel like she's where she was before, and, you know, has the next 6 months to sort of say, you know, you didn't do it for me last time, here's why. You know, I think you need to reconsider me.
Mm-hmm. There are a number of candidates who are lesser known, a guy named Richard Black, a guy named Mac Clifton, Mike Marazziti, he's a bar owner in Fells Point, and a young African-American graduate of the Harvard Business School, Calvin Allen Young. They've all declared. It remains to be seen sort of how they proceed in the process, but there's a lot of speculation that David Warnock, Taylor Stewart, will enter the race. He's expected to announce on Tuesday. He owns a financial firm called Camden Partners. He's the chairman of the Greater Baltimore Committee, the Center for Urban Families. He runs a foundation called the Warnock Foundation, been involved in education issues. Do you think a white candidate like David Warnock has a chance?
I think that that's an interesting conversation in Baltimore right now. So whenever you're looking at election pollsters, they're basically going through and saying, like, well, these are the neighborhoods that you will be able to play in. I think that what will be really important for David Warnock is to, and any candidate, is to make sure that they are actually building an expansive base, like, outside of the corridor from around the water and then going up straight north. Because I do think that that's a dangerous thing in our city right now, of this division of two Baltimores that people are talking about. And so I think regular kind of election ideas will tell you, like, okay, well, you got to go where you're going to get your votes. But I think that any candidate needs to make sure that they are going across the city and actually building a coalition of voters from east, west, and the center of Baltimore.
Mm-hmm.
One thing he could be focusing on or hoping for is just the split up of votes with so many candidates, mm-hmm. you know. This might possibly be an opportunity for, you know.
That was a strategy that Martin O'Malley employed,
yes.
back in the 90s, and it was successful for him because there were four or five very strong black candidates, and they sort of split the difference, and so, you know.
I would worry, though, that somebody has to actually build the conditions to be able to govern after they win, and especially because of where Baltimore is right now, this election needs to be about actually building up a citywide kind of coalition so that people can be successful.
All right. Well, thanks to you both. Fern Shen is the founder and editor of the Baltimore Brew, Taylor Stewart, the regional director of leadership for educational equity. Let us know what you think about the current crop of candidates or potential candidates. You can tweet us at Maryland Morning or drop us an email, mdmorning@wypr.org. Coming up after a break for the news, the story of WANN, a radio station in Annapolis that brought the African-American community together in the years following World War II. It's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Here's Nathan Sterner.
Thanks, Tom. You're listening to the Maryland Morning Podcast, a service of your public radio, WYPR in Baltimore. Find more podcasts at WYPR.org and tell us what you think by email, mdmorning@wypr.org. Now, back to the podcast.
On 88.1, it's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Now we're going to look back at an Annapolis radio station that broadcast music primarily catered to an African-American audience for 50 years, from 1947 to 1997. Ephemera and objects from the station, called WANN, are on display at the Smithsonian Museum of American History, which has a permanent exhibit that opened in July called American Enterprise. The exhibit traces America's development from a small, agriculturally dependent country to a global economic powerhouse. It's an eclectic collection. They have things like an early Monopoly board game and the name tag of a shoe clerk who worked at the department store Woodward and Lothrop. And to highlight the African-American experience from the consumer era, which is what the Smithsonian is calling the 1940s through the 1970s, they selected artifacts from WANN. Larry Blum is the son of the founder and owner of WANN, Morris Blum. He joins us on the phone from Glen Burnie, and joining us from Williamsburg, Virginia, is Dr. Charlie McGovern. He's the program director and director of undergraduate studies and associate professor of American Studies and History at the College of William and Mary. Dr. Blum and Dr. McGovern, thank you so much for your time. Appreciate it.
Much thanks.
Dr. Blum, let me start with you. Tell us how the station got its start. I guess your dad started it when he returned from World War II?
Yes. He'd been a communications officer with the United States Navy during the war, and his career goals after the war were to begin a radio station. He looked at various cities near his hometown of Baltimore, and he started a radio station in Annapolis, which was one of the few state capitals at that time that did not have a local radio station. Very quickly, the city had three radio stations. At that point, my father had a decision to make about the economic viability of a radio station facing a lot of competition in a small town. And that's where the idea of catering to an African-American audience slowly began to take hold.
And how did it start? What was the program format before he switched to that format?
It would have been general and basic radio. This was a radio station that got started before television. My father had employed at the end of the broadcast day, a disc jockey to play some records at the very last hour of the day from the local college of St. John's College. And my father had a collection of records in the back of the radio station then that his manager had advised him not to play. This was so-called race music in that time. And the manager had gone off on vacation, and my father gave the DJ the records to play for the last hour of the day. Usually fan mail had been minimal. All of a sudden, within a week of putting the show on, the mailbox burst open when he opened it at the post office, with fan mail coming out from all over the Chesapeake Bay region, from Baltimore, southern counties, eastern shore. So clearly my father realized there is an audience that wants to be entertained.
Yeah, the market proved itself. And Dr. Charlie McGovern, obviously Annapolis was segregated, Maryland and the country was segregated in the 1940s and the 1950s, but I guess the airwaves weren't. How did that work in terms of crossover between a white and a black audience?
The airwaves weren't segregated in the sense that you could turn the dial, but the stations that catered to African-American sounds were located all the way at one end or the other of the dial, the lower frequencies. In any city you went to in the 1950s, you could in effect find black voices and black music literally by spinning the dial all the way to one end or another. In that sense, people knew where to find those voices and that music. It was a lot easier to hear black music and for African Americans to hear the voices of their community speaking to them about their interests than it was for African Americans and whites to associate socially. And of course, there were many prohibitions in the North as well as the South.
Did stations like WANN, both here and around the country, did they have many white listeners?
One of the reasons that most stations began to cater to African American listeners was because they saw that market as untapped and, of course, very likely to be loyal, especially if the stations played the music that the people wanted to hear and had personalities who addressed them in ways that they wished to be addressed and spoke to their concerns. But increasingly, over time, white Americans picked up on the music especially. It wasn't surprising that most of these were young people because that music became, of course, the roots of what eventually we came to know as rock and roll. So there was a sense of attraction for a lot of young people. This music was different. It was exciting. It had a vibrancy that sometimes was missing from the general pop music of the day.
And Dr. Blum, I want to talk about a particular personality who was on WANN. This is Hoppy Adams. He was a DJ there for many years, and During the summers, he used to broadcast shows from a place called Carr's Beach. Tell us that story.
Bobby Adams had been hired by my father, at first as a part-time disc jockey and then later full-time. He actually had worked in other radio stations briefly before coming to work for my father. He already had been a bit of a local personality. He came from a very prominent African-American family in Annapolis, and he was an athlete, though impaired by polio. His gait was impaired, but he was an excellent swimmer, thus the name Hoppy. Carr's Beach was a segregated beach near Bay Ridge, Annapolis. The beaches, of course, in that era were completely segregated. There were two African-American beaches that catered to African-American audiences and patrons on weekends. One was considered, quote, the family entertainment beach, unquote. That was Sparrow's Beach. Carr's Beach had acts that were more secular in nature and was open to African-Americans, though whites were and other races were certainly allowed to attend if they wanted to.
We have a clip from Hoppy Adams broadcasting on WANN.
Honey, how would you like to see all the top recording stars this summer? Well, you can at Carr's Beach in Annapolis. This season will be jammed.
Dr. Blum, you went on to a career as a medical neurologist. When you were a kid, did you have a personal recollection of meeting Hoppy Adams? What kind of guy was he?
Well, quite well. I worked at the radio station as a teenager and young adult. But I actually worked in the radio station as a news person, broadcasting news for Hoppy, doing the engineering, answering the doors, helping him get his records ready. So in the summer times, I did all of that for him. He was very charismatic, particularly on the air. He had a lot of presence and a lot of dignity.
Dr. McGovern, the exhibit at the Smithsonian breaks this notion of the American enterprise into these broad chunks of time. They call one the merchant era, the corporate era. They talk about the consumer era, which they basically date from the 40s to the 70s. What does that entail? What does that mean?
The American economy emerged after World War II as dominant in no small part because it was the last one standing, so to speak. It had not experienced the same kind of devastation that most of the other powers in the war had done. And also, the economy was what some scholars have called Fordism. It was based on mass production and mass distribution, and things were geared toward the assumption that if you made good quality products at a low enough price, you could sell many of them. And thus the working class who made the products could also afford to buy them. And that was the formula that carried American business through the middle decades of the century, eventually replaced more and more by what we might think of as niche marketing rather than trying to reach everyone with the same product to really peg things to different economic levels and to different, if you will, cultural position. But from the 40s to the 70s, the United States economy was dominant because they had an equitable distribution of income, much more so than now, and because they were able to produce products at prices that working class wage workers were able to afford.
And Dr. Blum, we have a picture of a flyer that WANN Radio distributed to potential advertisers talking about the fact that its African-American audience was the largest outside of New York. Your dad was white, you know, you're white. Growing up, did you get a sense that it was unusual for a white man to own a radio station that catered to the black market?
Well, initially, no. When you're a small child, you sort of take it in stride. You figure this is one part of the world. I can say that thanks to the experience of having been part of WANN, I wasn't exposed in the context of work and family to some of the issues that were going on in society. I didn't see some of the tensions that were going on. As I got older, I began to realize not everybody enjoyed what we were doing. Not everybody approved. There were a lot of people that would make disparaging remarks, or who would keep their distance from our experience. At times, extraordinarily cold, to say the least, as to the reception Annapolis gave my father and gave the radio station. So in a sense, we were living in our own world.
Please don't go. Or never leave me, baby. Please don't go.
Was it financially viable? Was it successful?
I'd say that in the 50s, 60s, and into the 70s, we were doing very well. By the early 80s, not as well. All pioneers whatever they may be a pioneer in, find that at some point they're beginning to get a bit outmoded. Also, radio was changing. There was a lot more competition. Deregulation in the early 80s allowed for radio stations to pop up all over the dial, both in the AM and FM frequency. FM began to become more dominant.
Yeah, so there are a lot of other market forces affecting this, yeah. And Dr. McGovern, is WANN unusual? Is it unique?
It was not unusual at all for African-American-oriented radio stations to be owned by whites. In fact, when Mr. Blum started WANN, there was only one radio station owned by an African-American, and that was in WERD in Atlanta. By the end of the 1950s, there were only three stations owned by African-American. So the control of these businesses was in the hands of whites. That said, it was possible by the early 1960s to drive across the country through a southern route, if you would, and hear black people on the air all the time you were driving, if you basically drove during the day. That's how many stations were catering to African-American audiences. There were many, many stations that devoted some substantial portion of their airtime to having African-American voices on the air and broadcasting black music, essentially for black people.
And talk about this notion of race music and the crossover that eventually occurred. I mean, it's famously remembered by about Sam Phillips, the guy that discovered Elvis Presley, that he was specifically looking for a white singer who sounded black. And of course, you alluded to earlier the influence of so-called race music, black music, on what became American rock and roll. Where does that stand in this arc of history?
The same kind of Jim Crow that was in American society was also being used to categorize American music, even though we had and have plenty of evidence that African Americans and whites listened to one another, shared and stole traditions from one another. And again, of course, African Americans had much less power in this. Even though the music was mixed, the categories were separated. The idea that something was made by an African-American meant that it was largely geared to African-Americans. There were, of course, many important exceptions, Louis Armstrong, Duke Ellington, Ella Fitzgerald, among them. So race music was a slightly derogatory term that increasingly became more and more derogatory as African-Americans' freedom struggle grew in the 1940s. By the end of the 1940s, black performers like Lionel Hampton were rebelling against that term. They just wanted their music to be known as music and not have any race label attached to it. But that music was still largely segregated from white ears. You might hear Ellington or Lionel Hampton on a pop station, but you wouldn't hear H-Bomb Ferguson you wouldn't necessarily hear the Orioles out of Baltimore. That was music that was still geared toward African Americans. And it was the radio stations that broke that barrier down, because they didn't attract white listeners. And eventually the people who made the records realized that there was a broader audience for it. It was very much true that as white musicians openly acknowledged their debts to African American sounds and traditions, they drew a broader audience in for their music. And that's really how the barriers began to break down. A lot of it was commerce. You know, it wasn't about civil rights per se. But the market in that sense is very important. People will sometimes chase green where they will not necessarily be comfortable with mixing black and white.
Larry Blum is the son of the founder and owner of WANN Radio, Morris Blum. Dr. Charlie McGovern is professor of American Studies and History at the College of William and Mary. We've got more information and more of our conversation on our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall, ahead Ensemble Galilei. But first, here's a Baltimore story with Gil Sandler. Thank you.
you have thoughts on that segment you just heard? Email us at mdmorning@wypr.org or find us on Twitter. We're at Marilyn Morning. Now back to the show.
Ensemble Galilei has been mining the rich traditions of folk and early music for 25 years. They have played in concert halls and churches across the United States, Canada, and Mexico, and for 6 years, two of its members played weekly at Walter Reed Hospital, providing the comfort and consolation that only music can to wounded warriors. This weekend, they will unveil their latest CD, From Whence We Came, an eclectic mix of original compositions and music from around the globe. This is a tune called Lindsay's Keys. Carolyn Surik wrote this piece. She plays viola da gamba in Ensemble Galilei, and Catherine Montoya plays recorders and whistles on the album, and they both join me this morning here in Studio A. It's great to see you both. Thanks.
Thanks for having us.
Nice to be here.
And this record is really great. So, Carolyn, the whole raison d'etre of Ensemble Galilei in a lot of ways has to do with the collaborations you do with non-musicians. You've collaborated with people like folks from the Hubble Space Telescope or National Geographic. Tell us about that kind of work.
Well, we love doing that. I mean, we of course love doing straight-ahead concerts, but there's something wonderful about marrying words and music, and sometimes words and music and images. And we feel like it's a really powerful artistic medium. Really, really good.
You got a project like that in the works right now?
We do.
Up,
we
right?
got a crazy new project coming up, and that is very, very theatrical, working with three actors and four musicians, and it's very much in process. We've been working on it for a couple of years now, and it's so much more amazing than we thought it was going to be. It was like kind of like, wow.
What's the subject matter?
The subject matter is Galileo and his relationship with his daughter, Maria Celeste. And it's very funny, and it's heartbreaking, and it's beautiful, and it's goofy. It's kind of one of those, and sort of winsome.
Winsome.
Yes. Huh?
And of course, daddy-daughter stuff is always, you know, there's lots of stuff in there.
Well, and you have the Pope, too. So you have sort of the conflict between, like, who do I mean, he put his daughter in the monastery, and so she has these two fathers. She's got, or three, you know, she's got the Pope, and she's got God, and she's got her father, and they are in crisis with each other. I mean, those at that time. Anyway.
Yeah, so now these things, this isn't the kind of deal where you like go commission a script from somebody, they write it and they give it to you and you produce it. You're all collaborating.
We are. And that is, as anyone who has done a lot of collaboration knows, the more collaborating you do, the harder it is.
Yeah. Writing by committee can be difficult.
Yeah.
Let's listen to a bit of another track. This one features you, Catherine. This is a tune called John, Come Kiss Me Now. Pretty. That's so nice. Now, when you put together a tune like that, it's not like, you know, in my business, you know, this weekend on Sunday afternoon, I'm doing the Fauré Requiem and the Durufle Requiem. You go to the music store, you ask for the Fauré Requiem, they give you the music, mm-hmm. you do it, you go and you play it, right?
Yep.
It's pretty straightforward. But for this kind of music, you know, stuff that comes from folk traditions and from various places, how do you find this repertoire and how do you figure out how to arrange it?
Well, this particular piece comes from a collection called the Division Violin that was published in 1680s or something like that. And it works great on various treble instruments, and it's based on a ground bass, and it's just all these divisions on a very, very simple bass line.
Yeah, so it wasn't necessarily written for a recorder or pipes or something. It might have been written for Lord knows what.
Right? Yeah, you know, probably violin in mind, but it, you know, it works for a number of different instruments. And yeah. I thought it'd be nice, since the bass line is so simple, just to have Jackie play with me to add some more rhythm. And
yeah,
it's just a tune I like very much.
And so. Jackie is playing percussion.
Baron, right? Yeah, he's playing Baron. Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, beautiful. Let's listen to a little bit of Telemann. This is a track from a Telemann sonata for viola da gamba. Carolyn, your instrument. So this is an established, you know, Baroque composer, Telemann. What's nice about records like this is that this music is from all over the map. I mean, it's stuff that you've written yourself,
right,
you know,
right.
Contemporary music in that way, as well as music, you know, from the 1600s, the 1700s. You really, you just grab it from all parts of the bag, don't you?
We do. And in fact, this is a medley of two pieces. So the first piece is the Telemann, the first movement of the sonata. And then the second piece is a Swedish piece. And you're like, do those two pieces really work? I mean, what is the relationship between those two pieces? And this particular CD, I think, is really fascinating because more than any other project that we've ever done, it really is like walking into a journey. I mean, like you just sort of, a piece starts and you start in one place and then it turns a corner and you sort of see a different landscape in front of you. And I was very interested sequencing it. Like when you're sequencing a CD, you're deciding which piece goes in which spot. What is the order of the tracks? And it was a fascinating project to try to sequence, because what you really are doing in something like this, unlike like music and that's an all Irish CD, or even the Beethoven string quartets, where, you know, each piece goes to the next piece and you don't make those decisions. On a recording like this, you're really deciding what comes next and what makes sense to come next and what happens to the listener as you take them on this journey. It was really, really fascinating and really exciting.
Yeah, this is another medley. We won't have time to play the whole medley, but this is a tune that starts with Sophie's Slip Jig. Catherine, you play all over the world with Baroque ensembles and early music ensembles. Excuse me, you play classical music, you play folk music and stuff. When you work with Ensemble Galilei, what do you think sort of sets that apart, that experience apart for you?
I think part of it is that when they play with an audience or when they're on stage, sometimes in classical music, there's more of a barrier between you and the audience. And with this group, that barrier comes down very quickly. They talk to the audience. It's just a very intimate and fun way of performing and making music.
Well, this CD is a lot of fun to listen to, and appreciate both of you guys coming by and telling us about it and break a leg with it. Appreciate it.
Hey, thanks for having
us.
Carolyn Surik and Catherine Montoya of Ensemble Galilei. The new CD is called From Whence We Came. There's a CD release concert tonight in Annapolis at St. Margaret's Church, tomorrow night at St. Mark Presbyterian Church in Rockville, and on Sunday afternoon back in Annapolis at the Barn House. We've got details on our website, wipr.org/Maryland Morning. Nathan Sterner is our co-host, director, and engineer. Rob Sivek and Jonah McCone produced the program. And this morning, we're pleased to welcome to the Maryland Morning team producer Kathleen Cahill. Scott Seiss helps us out as well. Zeke's Coffee in Lauraville gives us our Java fix. You can find them online at zekescoffee.com. Thanks to Chris Kennedy and Clean Cuts for their theme song. Tune in Monday with the opening enrollment period for health insurance beginning this weekend. I'll talk to Kevin Lindemood from Healthcare for the Homeless, and we'll go to the theater. Kwame Kwe Arma joins me to talk about changes at Baltimore's Center Stage. Jaywin Russick will review the new show at the Everyman Theater, and we'll also check out the Charm City Fringe Festival. And by the way, don't forget to set your clocks back tomorrow night. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for listening. Happy Halloween.